Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The new SDPB documentary, Leaving Redfield, explores the progress from forced segregation of people with intellectual disabilities to a greater focus on all people living meaningful lives as they define them. The program premieres on SDPB on June 10th, and it looks at the deinstitutionalization of the Redfield Hospital and School. Start with the early 1900s to the current day. Writer Paul Higbee joins us from the Sue W. White Studio on the campus of Black Hills State University. Paul, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, good to be back.
This is a powerful documentary, and it involved talking to a lot of people, including people who lived in Redfield, who were institutionalized there. Take me back to, you know, like the earliest, the genesis of this project and how you first sort of saw it taking shape.
Well, this was a field I worked in through Black Hills Special Services out in Sturgis. And I remember the days that people were leaving Redfield and many other institutions across the country and coming back to their hometowns. And I was there trying to help set up housing and case management. Worked with a man named Bob Markvie, who was right in the middle of everything, too, both on the east side of the state and the west side of the state. And it was about 7 years ago. He said, you know, those people who came out of Redfield, they're not getting any younger. They're a lot of them in their 70s now. They've got remarkable stories, and maybe we should think about interviewing them, and so their stories are never forgotten. So about 7 years ago, we started driving across the state, interviewing everybody we could who had gotten out of an institution, and the interviews were just great. We Ryan Phillips was my cameraman and sound man, and we got some funding from some foundations to do that with the hopes that someday we could organize it all into a documentary.
We're going to hear some voices from the documentary, and the first one I want to play is Mark Sammis. Am I saying his name right?
Yes.
And he was in Redfield at the age of 15, and he was sent there because he was having trouble keeping up in school. And here's a little bit of him just talking about when he left and how it made him feel.
I had my freedom. When I left Redfield, from the moment, the day I left Redfield, January 8, 1974, that's when I got my freedom back. I could truly live free. Like Martin Luther King said in August 1963 at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, free at last.
That's a powerful memory that he has of leaving. Talk a little bit about why someone would feel that way. What were the conditions that they were in versus that would make leaving that big of a deal?
I think some of them didn't know that they didn't have any freedom until they left. Mark did. He was an advocate for himself very early on. But then when you get out of a place where you have to be really behind walls. You can't go into the community except with supervision and other people. And you look back on that, it's like, what on earth was going on to me? It was like one of our characters says, it was a lockup. I was locked up. And certainly times changed over the decades so that conditions were better at places like Redfield, but it's a word people don't like to use, but there certainly was a time where it felt like people were kind of warehoused there. And, you know, it just, that lack of freedom is what Mark latched onto and many other people, in other words, saying, you know, I couldn't go where I wanted to go. I couldn't be by myself. I couldn't decide what I wanted to watch on TV. I had to do everything as a group.
Let's go back to the beginning in the early 1900s. How did this begin as a facility? What was it originally called? What were the original intentions?
Well, for a lot of years, it was called the Home for the Feeble-Minded or the Home and School for the Feeble-Minded. And it was like other institutions in other parts of the country. This wasn't something South Dakota invented. Eventually, 1,200 people lived at Redfield. And It was following the model that had been established nationally. We might have had a little bit of an advantage in South Dakota in that our numbers were not as overwhelming as they were some places. But it really, I mean, there's no doubt one of the things these institutions did was keep people who had intellectual disabilities segregated from the rest of the citizens in their state. And so there's always kind of a mystery about these places, like who are those people who live there? Are they dangerous? Our popular literature, including John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, painted a picture of these being dangerous people. In Mice of Men, Lenny kills somebody because he doesn't know his own strength. And so a lot of people said, well, you know, there must be a reason why we're separated from that group of people. The other thing, too, that was happening in South Dakota is the state certainly had a policy for a while in the 1920s that it didn't want any more of these people born. And so there was involuntary sterilization happening so that they thought, you know, that will end people with intellectual disabilities. Not the case at all, of course.
Hmm. I want to talk more about just what daily life was like, and when does it start to become something that people are paying attention to and thinking we can do better? So I want to hear a little clip from former Governor Harvey Wolman, and he's talking about the first time that he visited Redfield.
It was a big building, you know, on the edge of town. And we went in there, and there were kids of all ages, from babies in the cribs to people who were, you know, older. And we got to visit several wards. And the conditions were appalling to me because there was no semblance of dignity about it. It was just, I hate to use the word warehouse, but that's the way it struck me.
Paul, why do people not like to use that? You mentioned it, and Governor Wolman mentioned it. It does seem, when you look at the history, that that's even some of the intent was warehousing.
Yeah, people don't like to use that term because it is a state institution, and it's like if you warehouse somebody, they're an object. They're not a human anymore, and That's what I think is so offensive about that term.
Yeah. They have no privacy, no private property, no freedom to talk a little bit about some of the, the dairy farm and the work that's being done. And at some point, the way the cows are even taken care of becomes into question because the cows are taken care of maybe a little bit better than the people.
There was a farm that raised food for use at the institution. Also, some of it was sold out in the community. And it was a good farm, and especially the dairy herd had a great reputation. They always took these cows to the state fair, and they won a lot of blue ribbons. But, you know, it's a big job to run a farm, and at some points people said, well, maybe all the work we're putting into the farm would be better suited going to care of people, and we can buy the food from someplace else. But I don't know. I go up to that part of the state, and people still remember that dairy herd up there. It might have been some of the best public relations that Redfield ever had was, wow, these people can run a farm. But, of course, that never should have been the priority. And I there are people who say, at times it was.
Tell me what it was like for parents who sent their children to Redfield. What did you learn from parents?
We interviewed parents, and they said time and time again, doctors almost always were the first people to say, you ought to put your child into Redfield. They said, for one thing, having a child with this sort of disability at home is going to disrupt your family life to such a degree that your other kids won't have a normal life. And we heard that so many times, people saying, doctors told us it was the best thing. Now, this would have been in the 1940s and 50s. Prior to that, there was actually, if you had an intellectual disability, you had to register, and the state could decide that you were going to go to Redfield. That slackened a little bit as we got into the middle part of the 20th century. But still, a lot of kids were going to Redfield because doctors and other trusted people in the community advised it. And also in those days, there were no special education programs in schools across the state. And so, you know, if your child was going to learn, going to become social, just have a life, there were not very many other options. And we did talk to parents who told us, you know, we couldn't even find babysitters for our children, mm-hmm. let alone talk about special services at a school.
We are talking with Paul Higbee about the new SDPB documentary, Leaving Redfield, and it premieres on SDPB TV on June 10th. Paul, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about this finding out how to leave Redfield and come into the community and some of the leaders of that movement. Stick with us on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking with writer Paul Higbee of this new documentary, Leaving Redfield, and you can see it on SDPB TV on June 10th. That will be the premiere. We're going to have more conversations about this documentary in the future. This is really just the beginning. Paul, let's talk about some of the people, and some of those people are the ones who are institutionalized. Some are parents, some are administrators, who started seeing a better way of doing business for people with intellectual disabilities and sending them to an institution. Where do you want to begin with that conversation?
Well, in the 1950s, at the University of South Dakota, there was a man named Dr. Henry Cobb, who was really a visionary, not only in South Dakota, but nationally, about how places like Redfield could send their people out into the community and help them build lives that the rest of us have. Jobs, housing, recreation in the community. He really was a pioneer, and I'm glad we could kind of recover his memory in this documentary. At the same time, there were active parent groups who said, we want to help find services in our communities, be it a small community or a larger community like Rapid City or Sioux Falls. We'll start our own schools if we have to. All the time working and being advocates for public schools accepting people with severe disabilities. And, you know, between Dr. Cobb and these parents who just all of a sudden in the 1950s got inspired to make things better for their children and other children who were going to Redfield, that's where it all began. And really then you came into the 1960s in the civil rights movement. And this was very definitely a part of the civil rights movement. There were people saying, you know, what are the rights of these people? You know, why are they behind walls? They didn't commit a crime. They're people just like the rest of us.
That transition has several different facets to it. One is simple as being in Redfield, in the school itself, and trying to figure out what are the ways to prepare people to go into a community simply like by labeling a bathroom, let's say, in a way so that if you're at a restaurant in a community, you can find, bathrooms have signs. And how complicated is it then once somebody has spent so much time institutionalized to transition to the place of their choice in community?
Yeah, it was complicated. For one thing, there were just people who had never been anywhere by themselves, and they were adults. And, you know, I think some of these people might have been in a restaurant, and it was like, who do I ask permission to go to the restroom? I can see it. I know where it is, but I've got this behavior I've lived with my whole life. You know, I've never done anything by myself. And, you know, some people adapted, had to figure it out really easily, and they felt liberated. Others, of course, it was scary.
Talk about some of the challenges from a neighborhood perspective. People not wanting, you know, group homes. How challenging were some of those community conversations to have?
I think you would look at some of those communities now and believe there never could have been a controversy here because the people who have these disabilities are active, beloved members of the communities. They're members of churches, they have jobs, they live in the neighborhoods with everybody else. But you go back to the 1970s, and the first thing some people said was, we feel like if a group home is built in our neighborhood, property values are going to go down. And we looked into this really hard. Property values didn't go down anywhere because a group home was built. It was, in fact, it enhanced neighborhoods in some ways because it was always a home that was well cared for. You often had 24-hour awake staff there, you know, which made the neighborhood safer. So that was something that had to be worked through. And some South Dakotans remember, you know, angry meetings at City Hall saying, you know, how can you move this home in here? And what's the safety factor? And what's, you know, what's going to happen to our property values? But South Dakota worked through that. And as I said, in those towns now, you just would never guess that was ever a conversation.
I want to play another clip from the documentary, and this one is Cary Grimm, and he's talking a little bit about transitioning into the community and how some people are going to try to take advantage of the newcomers.
He tried convincing me, Cary Lee, and telling me exactly in these exact words of, there is no sin in for you, Cary Lee, or anyone and everyone to go to see, attend strip club dances, lady strip club dances, if it's for the right reasons in God's eyes. But in God's eyes, I say, there is no right reasons.
And the reason I picked that little clip from Cary, Paul Higbee, is two things. And one, it gets at this idea of some people probably thought sending someone to an institution would protect them from predatory behavior. And there is some truth to the fact that people would want to take advantage. And also I picked this one because I just love how the clarity of what Cary has decided is right for him as an individual really gets to this point of you can't group all people in one category. Each person that you ask that question of would have had a different answer, just like everyone that was already living in that neighborhood. Say more about that, please.
Yeah, Cary is a person who has a remarkably strong set of personal values, and indeed, nobody was going to convince him to go to a strip club. But other people, it was like, well, you know, if this is what people do out in the community, maybe I should do that too. Most of the interactions that people who came out of Redfield had in the community were very positive, and that included people in their neighborhoods, people they met at jobs, people they met at churches. But yeah, they were certainly not people of one mind, and the community really made them think, what are my values? I'm in a place where my values matter now in how I live my life.
And that gets to something that the documentary does a really nice job of diving into, which is, you know, what is a relation, these individual rights, these civil rights to decide for yourself what you want your relationship to be, what you want your job to be, how do you want to decorate your own, you know, space. Talk a little bit, if you would, about that the people with intellectual disabilities who have gone on to really advocate and push the conversation forward bit by bit.
Yeah, there are a number of South Dakotans who have intellectual disabilities who have served on national advisory boards. In fact, Mark Sammis, who you played at the top of the interview, is very well known across the country. He's made it sort of a second career to go out and fight for civil rights. And that's why he's interested in people like Martin Luther King, because, you know, he feels that he's doing the same thing in South Dakota and other parts of the country. Two men out in Hot Springs, Steve Dahlman and Art Butcher, have been on the road for years, driving around, going to centers, community support centers for people with disabilities, telling people what their rights are. And, you know, you have a right to have a job of your choice, or, you know, if work isn't where it is for you, you know, you have a right to retire and do something else. And really, these people, the message that they're delivering out there is it's almost revolutionary. They've attracted a lot of attention.
I want to play a little more from Mark Sammis with some specifics on what his message is about what's next.
A job, a place to live, and where they can get the services they need to make it in the community. That's what we want. We aren't going to throw them out and put them on your, sorry, you're on your own. No, we want to make sure they have everything they need to make it into the community, to be a productive member of the community.
Paul, tell me a little bit about having worked in this field and then doing this documentary work. What did you learn that you didn't know before?
I think one of the interviews that really surprised me, I'd never thought about this before, but we interviewed Barbara Avery of Sioux Falls, who said, you know, we later on, the siblings in that family, when her sister was sent away, we started thinking, were we the reason that that she was sent away and didn't live with us? You know, were our parents saying we got to do this so we have a better life for our children who remain at home? And I heard that from some other people too. And I think in working in the field, what I didn't always think about enough was, you know, what about the home, the parents, the siblings? What is this whole experience of having somebody with an intellectual disability? How is it impacting everybody else in the family? You know, there's that movie Rain Men with Dustin Hoffman, where a person is institutionalized, and then later he found out that his siblings didn't even know he existed. And we found a couple of cases like that in South Dakota, too. And, boy, you talk about trauma for a family. That's it.
Mm. It seems to me like it tied into a little bit of the women's movement, too, and along with civil rights. And so many of these mothers were told by pastors, by doctors, this is what you need to do. This is what's best. We'll make this decision for you. And then many of these mothers are the ones who come together and say there has to be a better way to do this. But that's a delicate thing, because then it was also this sort of, you know, did we make a mistake? Did we make a decision that was wrong? There's a lot going on there for women and for families.
Yeah, there sure is. I mean, we talked to mothers who said there was never a time while they had a child with an intellectual disability where they could even leave the house. They couldn't find babysitters. Get a job? That was totally out of the question. That was and there were cases, too, where just the trauma of having a child with a disability, and that's not quite the right word, but right. That's how people felt, it caused divorces, too. So there were a lot of young mothers who were really, really on their own and maybe couldn't even find a group of friends because nobody could understand their child.
Mm. The work on this continues. SDPB will bring you more content regarding this documentary, Leaving Redfield. And Paul, on a final note, one of the things I also found interesting in our remaining 30 seconds is this notion of brain injuries, what we know now versus what we knew then, and how that fed into the fear of people who were isolated at Redfield, because we were all just one, you know, car accident or farming accident away from being sent away, and the sort of implications of that for people as well.
Hmm. That's a scary thing for people to think about. I might mention also Bob Bussey from Public TV, who stepped in and made it a real production. We owe him a lot.
All right. Thank you so much, Paul, for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Paul Higbee joined us from the Sue W. White Studio on the campus of Black Hills State University. The documentary is called Leaving Redfield, and it premieres for the first time Monday, June 10th at 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB 1.